Carver right now, 49 degrees. Both are seen in Kenosha. 41 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again. And that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. And on this Veterans Day here on WGTD, we're going to be replaying a conversation from the Morning Show archives. It was actually recorded back in 2003 on the occasion of the publication of a really extraordinary book called Medal of Honor, Portraits of Valor Beyond the Call of Duty. It gathers together more than 100 beautiful photographic portraits shot by Nick Del Calzo of Medal of Honor recipients. And accompanying each portrait is a story about that particular soldier and their experience. This book has been re-released this year in a third edition, revised and updated, with 12 new veteran portraits and a new foreword written by actor Bradley Cooper. The book, again published by Artisan, is titled Medal of Honor, Portraits of Valor Beyond the Call of Duty. Here is an excerpt from my conversation back in 2003 with photographer Nick Calzo.
How did you set about making contact with these Medal of Honor recipients and approaching them about the possibility of their images being captured?
Well, Greg,
this way?
I was fortunate that the... this project is co-produced really with myself and the Congressional Medal of Honor Foundation, and the Congressional Medal of Honor Society saw my previous work, and I suggested that we begin this project, and they wholeheartedly supported it, and because of their sanctioning of it, why it was relatively easy to gain access to each of the recipients who make their own decisions. So I traveled 25 states and met with many of these in their homes and photographed them there, or in some cases at conventions. But I also wanted to photograph them amid the icons of freedom in our country. So there are several, of course, at the Statue of Liberty and Lincoln Memorial and the Korean War Memorial and the Vietnam Memorial and others. And I felt that was important to display that. So we were able to get that done. And they were most cooperative, and I'm so privileged to have their stepping before my camera and putting their trust in me.
Was the work by your co-author, Peter Collier, sort of done concurrently? That is, was he with you and speaking with these veterans and gathering their stories in sort of the same experience?
No, actually, he was not with me, and most of the work was done when, not most, but a good portion of it was done when Peter got involved, and he had access to the citations, but spoke with him over the phone. But he did just an incredible job of crafting these profiles, just a very moving accounts.
I think so, too. What was your experience like, aside from the actual act of photography, which I am certainly anxious to talk with you about as well? But tell us a bit more about the experience of actually meeting these recipients of the Medal of Honor, more than 100 of them. And how varied an experience was that?
It was quite wide-ranging in many respects. But in other respects, it was very consistent, only because they all share a common bond in that they received the medal. And in that context, I felt that they all had about four qualities in common. One, they all experienced a defining moment, either being nearly killed or wounded and having another chance at life, which created a sense of context about their life. The next was, I think they have a sense of inner peace, having faced death some more than once, many times. They have this sense of inner peace. They also have a strong character, and you feel that. It resonates with them. But in addition to that, I think they exhibit an uncommon humility. And on a personal basis, I feel that our country, humility is undervalued in our country today, in our society. And these men exude it. And fortunately, I think they represent the real true spirit of America.
Typically, how long an encounter would you have with each of these men?
They would run from, in a couple of instances, a couple of days to... the last one I photographed, which was not in the book because of the deadline, I photographed him just last month at the convention, and he had to go on to a memorial service, so I had less than 5 minutes.
Hmm.
So they vary very considerably.
The appearance of these photographs are interestingly varied as well. In other words, as we page through this book, we are not seeing essentially the same picture over and over again, with just minute details altered. But
mm-hmm.
you approach each of these figures very, very differently, each one unique unto themselves. First of all, I'm wondering to what extent that was driven by the subject, I mean, each subject. For instance, did they make the decision about how they would be dressed, how they would be posed, if in fact a given photo would be taken in one of these historic places, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
How were all those distinctions drawn and decisions made?
Greg, that's a good question. I would say, with the exception of one image, they all put their trust in me and cooperated completely, fully. The only partial exception to that was Admiral Stockdale. When I made contact with him, I happened to be in San Diego at the time, and I traveled to San Diego where he is based, and he said he wanted to be photographed on the USS Constellation, and that was in my mind right from the beginning, but that was his request, and on the deck of the Constellation, and I totally agreed, and that was my idea to begin with, but I didn't share that with him. But they were very cooperative, extremely cooperative. And also, I wanted to, when you turn the page, wanted to have a little surprise. And so I try to use light as a way to create drama for some of these images. And some of them I thought about for quite some time. And Jack Lucas's photograph, I thought about it for 2 years, is how I wanted to honor him as the Marine in front of the Iwo Jima statue in Washington, D.C.
Hmm. Some are very formally dressed, and many of them have the Medal of Honor clearly visible. I don't think that's true in every single case.
That's right.
But What about that range of formality? Was that left up to each of these men, or did you have any input and bearing on that?
Well, I had some personal feelings. I think in some cases they are not wearing the medal. I left that up to them, but if they were going to wear the medal, I wanted it to be... I wanted it to appear in a proper setting. So some of them you'll see wear suits and ties, but there is cases where, for example, with General Brady, he wanted to be photographed with his daughter, who, by the way, is now a lieutenant and serving in Baghdad. But I photographed him in his home near Seattle, Washington.
Mm. And a very informal, a lovely but very informal picture, for instance.
Exactly, but I think that reflects who he is. He's, when you mention general, you think it's going to be very uptight and what have you. But he's a very casual guy and a loving father, and he wanted to be photographed in his office with the various accoutrements showing his religious influence, and so that's what he chose to do. And in that setting, I didn't think that wearing the medal was appropriate.
Hmm. The decisions that you made, to what extent were they made once you had met a given man and experienced his personality in person and realized who they were? Was it possible then to be that sort of spontaneous in a sense?
Uh-huh. Well, you know, I had some preconceived ideas, but in other cases, I had to just react intuitively on the spot, depending on how much time was available. And they were very cooperative, and they were very understanding about it. And almost to a fault, they were extremely extremely cooperative.
You mentioned the fact that you are devoted to black and white photography. Why black and white photography?
Well, in my mind, it's very direct. It's honest. I don't think any color would have added to the photographs. It would have probably diminished it and taken away. We all know what the flag looks like. So in many cases, you see the flag in the shot, but it doesn't add anything to it. And in photography, the eye goes to the lightest portion of the photograph first. And so I wanted to draw people's eyes to their faces and the most important element. So I just feel that black and white photography had, not only because of its tradition, but I think it's a very honest way to depict something. And there are very, very few images in my mind where you need color to tell the story. There's some undoubtedly work that way, but in most cases, black and white can carry the image very well.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite images in the book is of Robert D. Maxwell.
Ah.
The headline of his story is Wire Man. I don't remember now off the top of my head why he's known as the Wire Man. I think it has something to do with stringing phone connections out on the battlefield or something.
I think
like
so.
That. But his image is one in which you make such dramatic use of light. It is a solitary figure actually off to the right of the frame a little bit, and he is pretty much in darkness except for gentle light which illuminates his face, and we see him holding in his hands a formerly folded American flag. It's a beautifully constructed image, and one of many that are just beautiful to behold.
You're so kind, and you're totally very complimentary, and I really appreciate that very much. You also seem to appreciate photography as well.
I'm reminded of another interview I did a few months back with someone named Kevin Bubrisky, who did a book about some of the people who have come to Ground Zero in New York City. His book is called Pilgrimage, and he also used only black and white photography. And actually, that book has no text. All we see really are these images of nameless people, not famous people at all. Mm-hmm. But I think ever since reading that book and studying it, I know better than I would before how black and white photography, in a sense, can be especially powerful. As you talked to these men, what was the range of experience and emotion that was shared? I'm asking, I guess, for these men, how wide a span are we talking about in terms of those, in the way that they look back upon what in most cases are really quite terrible, horrifying sorts of events to live through. What are the things that remain with you most, and how wide a span of experience are we talking about, at least in what they shared with you?
Well, some of them, the photographic session was rather brief, but I deliberately did not ask them about their combat experience. I chose not to do that. I had their citations in advance. I read it, and I knew essentially what had transpired. Because many of them, it's very painful for them to relive those moments. So I chose not to do that. However, I come back to an experience I had with Jack Lucas, whose photograph I did at the Iwo Jima statue. And following that event, he invited me to have lunch with his family. And after lunch, I told him that I'd been thinking about his portrait for a couple of years and wanted to do something to honor him and his valor. And he saw the Polaroids of the shot and was quite touched by it. So following lunch, he had to leave to catch a plane. And as we parted, he hugged me and kissed me on the cheek, and we had tears in our eyes. And it was a very poignant moment for the two of us.
Hmm.
And I hold him in high regard.
His story is one of the most striking that's told in the pages of this book, not only because, but partly because of the fact that he was 17 years old when the Medal of Honor was pinned on his chest. Can you tell us a bit more about the events which led to his being awarded the Medal of Honor?
Well, you might recall that he forged his signature, his mother's signature, to enlist in the service, and that was at 13 years old. And then because supposedly he looked older than his age and he had gone to military school and there was a need to have people train people to march and so forth and so on, he did that. And then through a series of circumstances, he was on various ships and was considered AWOL. And then he's finally discovered by an officer and who was going to consider him a deserter, and he pleaded with him. He said, "Please send me into combat." And he was desirous of getting into combat. And the second day he was on Iwo Jima, two hand grenades were hurled nearby, and he hurled his body upon them. One did not discharge, the other one did, and resulted in near mortal wounds. And when the medics went over to him, they yanked the dog tags off of his neck, but then noticed his finger was flinching, and so they realized he was still alive, and then administered some morphine and life-saving attention. And then he went on to have 22 surgeries, 22 operations, but he fulfilled his pledge to his mother and returned to his ninth grade class to complete his education.
Yes, and Mr. Collier says he promised, fulfilled that promise to his mother, went back to school, a ninth grader wearing the Medal of Honor around his neck.
Isn't that incredible? Isn't that astonishing? How many ninth graders today could possibly relate to that?
Hmm. Nick Del Calzo, and that's just one of the many memorable and moving stories that are part of this extraordinary book called Medal of Honor, Portraits of Valor Beyond the Call of Duty, which has just been re-released in a third edition, revised and updated, published by Artisan. Part two of the morning show is coming up in just a moment here on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. Coming up on Tuesday evening, November 15th, 7:30 p.m. at Wartburg Auditorium on the campus of Carthage College, there is a special event going on called Vet Night of the Arts, in which staged reading, dance pieces, and video pieces are going to be presented, which will touch on various aspects of the experience of veterans. This is a free event, but a suggested donation of $10 will be taken at the door, and all proceeds will go to Veterans Outreach of Wisconsin. One of the participants in that event Tuesday night will be a faculty colleague of mine, Mark Miller, who I interviewed several weeks ago about his memoir recently published about his experiences as a soldier in Vietnam, a book called Confessions from Vietnam. Here's a portion of our conversation.
Right.
You've mentioned that one of your most painful memories of Vietnam is an incident in which you thought your squad was maybe repelling an attack or picking off snipers or whatever with, I forget if it was a grenade or something that was thrown, but ultimately when you went to look, what was found was a woman and her baby. I'm just curious, when you probably never in a million years imagined that you would ever be part of something like that. What was it like to think about that and write about that and revisit that really painful moment?
Yeah, that was probably one of the worst things about reopening my journal, because that was very difficult. And what it was, we were out on a night ambush where we were set up next to a trail that the Viet Cong were known to travel on at night.
Hmm.
And it was pitch dark, jungle noises, and you start hearing sounds coming down the trail. And you had mines and grenades and things like that set up along the trail. And you had to make the decision whether you're going to blow the ambush, blow up the mines or not. And we did. The next morning when we went back to look, we found that it didn't turn out the way we imagined.
Right. Yeah, and it was not would-be snipers that...
Right, but nobody should have been on that trail in the middle of the night either.
Right, right. One of the things that's interesting now is that not only have you written this book, but now you're beginning to talk about this. What is that like to be, first of all, fielding questions about your experiences there? Because in some ways you control the narrative when you have written a book, but when you begin to open yourself up to the questions that get posed to you, it's a whole different kind of thing. What does that feel like?
It is very different, and this is, as we talked earlier, the first experience I've had actually talking about it, although I am going to have some other opportunities to do that. And it's interesting, I guess, since I'm used to the classroom and telling stories about my background in business, that it isn't too foreign. But obviously there are some things that memories that cause me some pain.
Yeah, I bet. Professor Mark Miller, he is going to be one of the participants in this special event for veterans in our community that will be taking place Tuesday evening, 7:30, at Wartburg Auditorium on the campus of Carthage College. And we'll be hearing more about this event on Monday's morning show with theater professor Martin McClendon, who is the organizer of Tuesday night's event. Part 3 of today's morning show coming up in just a moment here on WGTD. For part three of today's morning show, we are replaying a conversation from last week that ended up being bumped to a different day. We want to make sure everybody had an opportunity to hear about a very intriguing presentation which occurs this weekend at Carthage College. And for this portion of WGTD's morning show, I'm delighted to welcome back into our studios Neil Sharnick, who is a faculty colleague of mine at Carthage College, assistant professor of theater, and director of their latest production, which is a very, very old play done in a wonderfully sort of new style or within a new framework. The play is called Marriage à la Mode, and it's by the British playwright John Dryden, and it dates back to the late 17th century and is what we think of as a restoration comedy and part of the restoration period. And we will talk about what that means and complicated and wonderful plot of this play. And we'll also talk about the way in which it has been framed in a time period much closer to our own and given a couple of different twists that are sure to make it an even more entertaining and interesting night. So we have Professor Sharnick with us, and we also have a member of the cast, Cassidy Scorgia, who is a sophomore at Carthage. Cassidy, are you a theater major?
Yes, I'm a music theater major.
Music theater major. It's great to have both of you here. We welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
So, Neil, let's look back first at this play itself as it sort of originally took shape in the 1670s at some point by this gentleman named John Dryden. Might be interesting for you to say a word about this notion of the Restoration comedy and what had occurred in English theater right before this. It's a
sure.
fascinating story.
Yeah, well, Restoration theater, the Restoration is important, obviously, historically and politically, but is very important to theater scholars. It's an interesting period because it's very different from, you know, when people think of classical English theater, they likely think of the Elizabethan period. They think of Shakespeare. But not long after Shakespeare's life, in 1642, the monarchy was overturned in England. The Puritans took over and under Oliver Cromwell. And we reached this period called the Interregnum, or the Commonwealth. It's 1649, King Charles I was beheaded by these Puritans. And we have this period in which, among other things, the Puritans, as one might guess if one understands Puritans, they didn't care for theater, and they officially closed. There was no legal theater in England for a period of 18 years. Mm-hmm. When the monarchy is restored, and the reason we call it the Restoration, in 1660, one of the first acts of Charles II is to issue patents to open a couple of theaters in London to a couple of his loyal friends. But what's happened is the court has been abroad and has been taking in the theater of the continent. So when the theater reopens, it doesn't really look or sound very much like Elizabethan theater. It's more like the French. It's more like, you know, the theater of the courts they've been visiting, which is very significantly different. It's an indoor theater. It's a courtly theater. And comedy really steals the day. After this Civil War, the English Civil War, they're not particularly interested in serious drama. And as one might guess, after years of Puritan repression, the plays get pretty bawdy. Right? That is another defining factor. They're excellent wit comedies, really smart, but
naughty.
But they can be naughty. Yeah.
When you said they went to the Continental theaters.
Yeah.
Who is they?
Well, they is the Cavalier Court. They are those who are loyal to the monarchy when the Puritans take over.
Loyal to the monarchy that's been deposed
dethroned. The rightful king is in exile, and many of these loyalists lost property, lost their possessions, lost everything by choosing to support the monarch. Now, this idea of the deposed and rightful king is prevalent in Restoration theater. There's hardly a serious play in the period without a usurper and a rightful monarch seeking to get his crown restored, because that's the narrative, that's the story that people are interested in hearing and telling.
You know, as a youngster, I was just trying to quickly look this up. I remember going, the film Cromwell, it was way before you were born,
right.
Starring Richard Harris.
I've seen that again.
I'm sorry?
I've recently seen that again. It's
well,
great.
I saw it in the theater. I don't know what possessed my parents to bring me along, but I would have been 10 or 11 when that film was in the theaters, and albeit at a distance, but you actually see that moment where the king is beheaded.
Right.
And I still see that to this very day. I feel like I'm permanently scarred by the trauma. But, and of course, I don't think I began to understand all the intricacies of what was going on there politically.
Sure.
It's just not a film for an 11-year-old.
Well, the nation was scarred, too. And I think it's part of why they weren't especially interested in serious stories afterward. It was a time of celebration and a time of escape. Was that, you know, the Restoration actually, I mean, in 1665, plague sweeps through London. In 1666 is the Great Fire of London. I mean, it's just a horrible, horrible time. The Anglo-Dutch wars are being waged.
Right. So one dark chapter after another.
Yeah, right. So theater is very much a place of escape in this period. There's very little lofty about it.
Right. Very good. So that sense of national trauma, as England tries to escape that, theater, as you're saying, becomes one of the primary means of that escape out of the dark, sad abyss. And so it's mostly comedies. And this is evidently one of the most famous of the period, John Dryden's Marriage a la Mode. Can you say a quick word about who John Dryden was?
Sure. Dryden was a British poet laureate in the period. And one of the things that I find most interesting and exciting about him is that he was an innovator. It's a period where there were pretty strict rules, these sort of neoclassical ideals for what should happen on a stage, for the rules, for what makes a good play. And Dryden was an innovator. Dryden developed new forms, and this play is definitely one of them. It's a play that held the stage for a while in the period, but I think actually how innovative it was, audience didn't always know what to do with it sometimes. It's we often call it a split-plot tragicomedy, meaning there are really two very separate plots that we're following throughout the play that alternate one to the other. And one is sort of more, it's not a tragedy, but it is loftier, it is more serious. It's a heroic, idealized story, right? A story of young lovers being separated, torn by love and duty, where the other plot is, I mean, now we just call it a sex farce, right? It's couple of couples running around cheating on each other,
right, and nearly running into each other over and
right,
over and
exactly.
over again. Yeah, and you know, it's funny. As I read the at least the bare bones outline of the plot, this just shows how ignorant I am about theatrical history, I suppose. But I was just kind of shocked that was the plot. And no bones about it. I mean, it's not even particularly subtle. It's not like a play of double entendres or something. I mean, this is
There is plenty of that and plenty
sure.
of... In fact, I believe the word double entendre is introduced to the English language in this play.
Ah!
I remember when I was taking a Restoration seminar in Madison, one of my... we're all nerds. We're in a doctoral seminar. And one of them had pulled out the OED and looked this up and actually saw the first cited use of double entendre was after Marriage a la Mode.
Ah.
But it's in the play. So they got it wrong in the OED.
Oh, boy.
We caught them. and the play is full of it. It's very – there's lots of dirty jokes and suggestive
right.
humor. And it is a strange place to be as a professor explaining dirty jokes to your to your students, to your cast, when they don't get it and they have to understand what they're saying.
Right, exactly. So, Cassidy Scorgia, you're one of the members of the cast. You're a sophomore. So, first of all, coming to this, I mean, seeing the announcement of auditions and so on, did you know anything at all about Marriage a la Mode or John Dryden or Restoration comedy? I mean, or is this pretty much a brand new terrain for you and I presume for most of your castmates?
Yeah, no, honestly, looking at first, I was very confused. I was just like, I've never heard of this. I was the same thing where I was thinking more of the Elizabethan, the Shakespeare kind of era. So coming into this project, I was actually a little bit nervous because I don't have a lot of experience with, like, more classical theater. So I wasn't really sure what to expect. But this process has just been really, really interesting. And to like be able to study the language and to search for not only the deeper meanings of, I mean, obviously there are a lot of dirty jokes, but also to find like the, like to find an understanding of this heightened language and how natural, I guess, it's become to speak this way. It's like, as far as we are in the process now, it just feels natural. It just rolls off the tongue now. And it's there's a certain melody, I think, to the language and certain beauty to it that I've actually really, really enjoyed.
So, for instance, when people go to this, will it feel like seeing a Shakespeare play in terms of the language? And I'm thinking particularly of the fact that when most Americans, when they listen to a Shakespeare play, really have to listen because it doesn't. We don't take it in as effortlessly as if we take in something else that's a little closer to our own day. It's English, but not our English in a sense. I mean, in what way does this language compare to that?
Well, it isn't Shakespeare. And this one of the ways that the two plots are distinguished is that in the low comic plot, no one speaks in verse. And Shakespeare would often make this distinction as well, so it's not new. But we did make some alterations. I've adapted the language some because we are not setting the play in the 17th century. We have actually I re-envisioned it in the 1930s, which is something, of course, people do with Shakespeare all the time too, is find new locations. But I think this was a really attractive time, and for one reason, Dryden used a lot of music. There's lots of opportunities for music throughout the play. And when trying to figure out what is the right music now for this story, what is the music that's going to complement it? Some late 20s, early 30s jazz was what seemed most attractive. So we've actually built in quite a bit of music to the show.
We should maybe mention that specifically when this play was first done, there were at least two songs in it.
Right.
And with words by Mr. Dryden, music by somebody else. But so right from the start, music has been integral to this play.
Yeah, the play begins actually with Cassidy's character, Duralis, saying, "Oh, Beliza, let's work on that song the princess gave me to sing." And they just start with a song, you know, to set the show off. We've used the text for Dryden there. That Dryden gave us there and set it to new music. There's another song later that one of his texts we've cut. We've cut down the show just a little bit. It's a bit long. But there are two or three other times where he says that people are singing, so we just ran with it.
I can never remember the term, but there's a very fancy term for when a song in a play is actually a song versus, you know, some inner monologue for the character, but it's actually the character then is singing a song, and everybody around her or him knows that they're singing a song.
Right, this isn't a musical theater moment where they're expressing deep feeling and it into song.
The character is just, it's like when Maria's teaching Doe a deer, a female deer, to the kids. That's this kind of song, whatever you call that. Are most of the songs in this play of that nature?
They are. They all are. Mm-hmm. And it's part of why we've said it not just in 1930s Sicily, but specifically in a jazz club, because it is a context where people are singing songs, and it makes a lot of sense that these characters are singers and would be performing intermittently.
Right. Let's talk to Cassidy about her character, and I believe you are part of the subplot that involves the two pairs of cheaters, so to speak. Tell us more about who you are in this particular subplot.
Sure.
It's really not a subplot. It's the second plot.
Right.
It's
the other plot.
Yeah, the other plot.
Yeah. So Duralis is she's been married to Rodophil, who's the captain of the guard, for about 2 years. 3 years, depends on who you ask. We have a little bit of a discrepancy there, I think. Like Rodophil and I mean. They've been very frustrated because their marriage hasn't been working out that well. And then she meets Palamede, who is a cavalier. He's been traveling. He's charming and he's boisterous and he
likes her a lot.
And he likes her a lot, which is very exciting because, you know, it's...
Because her husband doesn't.
Right. Right. So Duralis is very, as a character, she's typically very put together. She's very intelligent. She's usually one step ahead of everybody else. but I think it's really interesting because you get to see these moments where, like, you really see that all she really wants is love. Like, the reason she likes Palamede so much is because she sees an opportunity to get the love that she's been lacking in her marriage.
There's something really genuine there.
Yeah, yeah. So she puts on this. I think she puts on a little bit of a brave face. She's, you know, she hides behind her intelligence and how she's very smart and she's very confident and she has a lot of moments where she's very coy. But it's like deep down, all she really wants is to be loved and to be able to love in return.
Hmm.
Yeah. And I think ultimately she wants her husband's love, but he has lost interest and. Yeah. This is in part to fill the need he's not filling and in part maybe to rouse his jealousy and get his attention back.
There you go. Professor Sharnett, can you say a word about, and I'm glad you're grabbing your,
you're grabbing your coffee,
in a second I'm going to have you sing, so I thought you were grabbing your ukulele. You should grab it in a moment or so. Professor Sharnett, say a word about the decision to move this into this particular period of the 1930s. You might have touched on this briefly, but explain why this particular period you thought was particularly fitting.
Well, needing music for the show and being pretty well resigned that I wasn't going to make this a Restoration-style play, though it came from there, I was listening to a lot of music, and I stumbled upon and started listening to some songs by Helen Kane, who people mostly know as the inspiration for Betty Boop. And I listened to as I was listening through her music, first song I hear is I Want to Be Loved by You, which people know Marilyn Monroe singing in Some Like It Hot, which is a great monogamous love song, right? You, only you, nobody else but you. And the next song I hit is I Want to Be Bad, which is not that, you know. And I thought, you know, how great with this split plot comedy, which I think the reason for having it is to put these two different notions of love and the pursuit side by side and have them sort of act as foils to each other and comment on each other. What fun would it be to take a period where the songs seem to be doing the same thing? There's still a lot of beautiful love songs and love ballads of the late 20s and 30s, but there's some very lively and very fun songs that are about not behaving well, right? So by setting it in that context, I was able to find songs that I really enjoyed and thought highlighted and emphasized the themes we were working with.
Fantastic. Yeah, that sounds like a great move on your part, and what a fun opportunity for your cast members. So, Cassidy, what do you want to sing for us?
Oh, I don't know. What would you prefer?
I think she has two ready that she sings and plays. One is Dryden's A Foolish Marriage Vow, the first song he opens with, might be fun. But she also sings I Want to Be Bad, the Helen Kane. Maybe we could excerpt them both a little.
Yeah, later. Actually, that would be really fun if that's okay. So why don't you give us a little taste of both? So why don't we start with Mr. Dryden?
Sure.
So remind us what this song is again.
A Foolish Marriage Vow. I guess I don't know if that's what the song is called, but that's the first line.
And is this the something like the original music that was used when the play, or what is the music?
The music, well, I just wrote out the tune and actually asked a student, Emma Terrell, to turn it into an accompaniment. So we have a piano accompaniment for this as well.
So the tune came from where?
From me.
Oh, from your genius. Okay, got it. All right.
From my genius, of course.
All right.
Why should a foolish marriage vow, which long ago was made, oblige us to each other now, when passion is decayed? We loved and we loved as long as we could, till the love was loved out in us both. But our marriage is dead when the pleasure is fled. 'Twas pleasure first made it an oath.
Oh, I like that, and I love your voice.
Oh, thank you. Oh, good.
Great. Cool. Yeah. So there's the beginning of the beginning of our show and the
beginning
of Dryden's
song. So that's
song.
The thing that your friend asked you to
to work
do
on.
With yeah. you and yeah mm-hmm. cool
and it's that song's very fun because it pops up a couple times throughout the show,
right?
Mostly me singing it.
Yeah,
Duralis kind of the themes kind of pop up for her throughout the show, so
right. fun. That fun. She's the song says, if I have pleasures for a friend and further love in store, what wrong has he whose joys did end and who could give no more?
Right, right. right.
So we hear these words a few times throughout the course of the play. We've sort of split up the song and are using it that way.
Right, right. Okay, give us a little of I Want to Be Bad. And we'll hope your dear a saintly mother isn't listening or whatever.
Oh, she's great. She's supportive. It'll be all right.
Well, all right. Okay.
If it's naughty to rouge your lips, shake your shoulders and shake your hips. Let a lady confess I want to be bad. If it's naughty to vamp the men, sleep each morning till after 10. Then the answer is yes, I want to be bad. This thing of being a good little goody is all very well, but what can you do if you're loaded with plenty of health and vigor?
Oh,
sure, yeah. I think you're going with
that's great. And I can see how that really can fit the show if you place it in just the right place. That's great.
Yeah.
Wonderful choice. Wonderful choice. Professor Charnick, we just have a couple of minutes, but I want us to just spend a little bit of time talking about this other plot because it's so comical. And just sort of lay out at least the framework of what occurs with Palmyra and Leonidas.
Yeah, so the story is that our usurper, he's held the crown for about 16 years. He was general to the previous king, Theagenes. When they put down a civil war in Sicily, the king was slain, and Polydamas stole the crown, despite the fact that Theagenes had a three-year-old, an infant son. So when he marched back to the capital, the queen fled with her infant son, and also Polydamas, the usurper, his wife, so outraged and ashamed of his treachery, fled with them. So he has been, for all these years, seeking for some news what happened to his wife, who was pregnant at the time, and what happened to the queen and the infant son. They got word of these two youths, a shepherd and his beloved, out deep in Sicily, who their grace and carriage and whatnot is such that it suggests they may not be who they claim to be. So they've moved the court out here to Sicily, and they've sought out these two young people. And what he doesn't know is one his child, and is one the prince, or is the boy the prince? He doesn't know. So he has to rely on other people who lie to him and whatnot. Yeah. So it becomes this complication where for a moment we think one is crowned and then the other crowned, and it complicates their lives because they are deeply in love. And
right.
when one is a prince and the other is nobody, then
they can't be married. And if she's the princess and he's nobody, they can't be married. And so just
whatever happens, it's going to be difficult.
Yeah. Oh, I just that plot I just absolutely love. It's just so brilliant, as is the other, as is the whole thing. And this is, of course, one of those plays that someone who knows a bit about theater might know the name, and yet this play does not get done all that often. It's a rare treat.
Yeah, my student dramaturg was looking, and the most recent professional production of it anywhere that she could find was in the 1940s.
Wow!
So it is in London, and it's been quite a long time. And I think that we've found a way, with the new setting in the 30s, with a little bit of adaptation to the script, to really make it work very well now.
Yeah. Oh, and who knows? Maybe this will be the start of something big in which other people will take notice of this play and maybe even do it in the format you've created
here.
I
love that.
Yeah. So this is the second weekend of performances of this play called Marriage à la Mode by British playwright John Dryden. And if you would like information about the play, you can go to carthage.edu/theater. Otherwise, you are encouraged to arrange your tickets at carthage.edu/tickets. It's a very simple process, and tickets will also be available at the door at the box office. Monday on the morning show,